gonna go on Facebook Live. Okay. Okay, everybody. Good evening. Today is Monday, January 29th, and we are here at United Orthodox Synagogues in Houston, Texas, for our Monday night class. And today we are in the series called Masters of the Mishnah and the Life and Times of the Great Masters of the Talmud. And today's episode is about Sumkus. And Sumkus is a fifth generation Tana. Hello. A fifth generation Tana. The period of the Tanaim is from the year 40 to the year 200. So he's towards the end. This is the last generation of Tanaim. It's generally debates about how many generations of Tanaim there are, but generally understood to be the end of the Tanaitic era. And Sumkus is an interesting fellow, as we're going to see, based on his history. There's a debate, actually, what his full name was. some have him as Sumkus ben Yossi, Sumkus the son of Yossi. Some have him as Sumkus ben Yosef, or Bar Yosef, the son of Joseph. And some have him as Sumkus ben Isi. So I don't think there's a different people. All of the various publications that talk about Sumkus assume it's one person, with some uncertainty as to what his father's name was. Okay. Now Sumkus. I mentioned before that he's a fifth generation Tana. According to other source, he is a fourth generation Tana.
Briefly, who are they?
The Tanaim are the rabbis in the Mishnah, the rabbis of the Mishnaic period, and they're the ones who are named in the Mishnah as the authors of certain halachot. And then the Amoraim, the next generation, those are the rabbis of the Talmud, right? So they come later. Okay. So one other note. Let's begin. Sumkus was, and this is probably perhaps the most important thing to know about him because it's going to affect his life, was a devout student of Rabbi Meir. Okay, another Tana. And he took it upon himself to defend the honor of Rabbi Meir and to make sure that Rabbi Meir's halachot were studied properly. And we're going to see an episode in his life where that's the case. And we're also going to see that Sumkus had somewhat of a reputation. Okay, so let's start in the source book, page number one. So we're talking about Sumkus, but his teacher was Rabbi Meir. So let's learn a little bit about Rabbi Meir first. So on the bottom of page one, on the right side, it says Amar Rabbi Acha Bar Chanina Galui V'Yadua Lifnei Mi Shamar Vaya Olam. She'ein b'doro sh'Rabbi Meir k'moto. It is known before the one who spoke and the world came into being, meaning God, right? Meaning this is a fact, an undisputable fact, that in the generation of Rabbi Meir, there was no one sage who was his equal. U'mimnei ma lo kavu halacha k'moto. Why then didn't the sages establish halacha in accordance with his opinion? Right? Meaning if he's the greatest sage, if he's the smartest guy in the room, why isn't the halacha always follow Rabbi Meir? And this is a fascinating answer. He was actually too smart for his own good. Shelo yachlu chavei rav la'amod al sof dato. His colleagues were unable to ascertain, it says here, the profundity of his wisdom. They couldn't understand what he was getting at, what he meant to be the halacha. Why? Shehu omer al tameh tahor umarelo panim, al tahor tameh umarelo panim. As he would state with regard to the ritually impure item that was pure and display justification for that ruling, and likewise he would state that regard to ritual pure items that it is impure and display justification for that ruling. And the commentary says the sages were unable to distinguish between the statement that were halakha and those that were not. He was too smart for his own good. He would come into a room and he would give arguments for both sides, and you were not able to, they were not able to ascertain what his true position, what his true position was. Okay? So that is, it's important to note that about Rabban Gamliel, because we're going to see something about the way Sumkus did halacha. I'm just getting a message here that my camera is not on. Hold on. Oh, the camera's on you, Ron Cameraman.
Oh, my God.
I got to turn my camera around.
No wonder it broke.
Holy mackerel.
Oh, jeez.
How do I do that? Let's see. There we go. Now it's me. Okay.
You should have had it on my wife, you know.
All right. Ron, you were famous. You had your 6 minutes and 28 seconds of fame on Facebook. Okay.
All over the world.
Now you can't run. You can't hide. Okay.
Well, I've been here.
So that's Rabban Gamliel. Okay? So he was a genius, but he was too smart for his own good. Now let's learn about his student. Okay? Let's turn to page 2. And we're going to see the third paragraph on page 2. Now we're moving our attention to Rabbi Meir's student, Sumkus, and the subject of tonight's discussion. Amar Rabbi Abahu. Rabbi Abahu said, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, name Rabbi Yochanan, Talmid haya lo l'Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Meir had a student, the Sumakus Shemo, right? Our friend Sumakus, Sumkus was his name. Shaya Omer, now let's look, listen to this carefully, read this carefully. Shaya Omer al kol davar v'davar shel tum'ah, arba'im ushmona ta'ame tum'ah, v'al kol davar v'davar shel tahara, arba'im ushmona ta'ame tahara. With regard to every matter of ritual impurity, he would give 48 reasons in support of ruling of impurity, and with regard to each and every matter of ritual purity, 48 reasons in support of ruling in purity. So now we can compare him to his Rebbe, to his teacher. What's the difference, or similarity, if you will, between Rabbi Meir and Sumakus? When Rabbi Meir discussed halacha, what did he do? Right, he gave an argument for both sides, which led to, shows everyone how smart he is, but it led the generation to not ruling in his like him. Okay, and what did his student do?
Looks like the same thing. No?
No, he gave 48 reasons for impurity and 48 reasons for purity, but he was arguing against.
Right, he was straight. He said, oh, this is impure, and here are reasons why. This is pure, and here are reasons why. It sounds to me like he learned from his teacher's mistake, right? Rabbi Meir was able to give both sides, and people didn't know, you know, they thought he was inconclusive, or he couldn't make up his mind, or maybe they shouldn't follow him, because if he could do both, that's not a good methodology, right? And comes along Sumakus, his student, he doesn't do that at all. He does the opposite, because maybe he realized my teacher, who was so smart, right, his rulings weren't followed. If I want my rulings to be followed, I have to be clear. I have to be decisive when making halachic rulings.
It says on the first page that he gave justification. Isn't that if I'm trying to prove something and I justify it with facts? It doesn't say 48, but then that it is pure and display justification for that ruling.
No. He would state with regard to the impure that it was pure and display justification for that ruling, and likewise would state with regard to pure and prove that it was impure. So he was going back and forth. Well, Sumacus said, this is pure, and here's why. 49 reasons why. Like he went. It's almost like overkill. Like my teacher would give reasons for both, but I'm not only going to justify one ruling, I'm going to justify it 49 ways. Okay? So Sumacus is known as being a very a genius, right? He's known as being a genius of his generation. Now, not being a genius myself, I'm not sure if it's a good thing or a bad thing, but we'll see that for Sumacus, right, his intellect wasn't always respected or, let's say, appreciated by the other people in his generation. And we're going to see a couple of examples of that. Okay, by the way, these pages of that we just read in the Gemara that come from, I don't have it written here, that come from Masechet Eruvin, discuss a lot of reasons why certain rabbis were accepted in their rulings and why certain rabbis were not accepted in their rulings. We're only focusing on Rabbi Meir and Sumacus, but there's a discussion about Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel, you know, famous sparring partners when it comes to ruling in halacha, and others as well. So it's worthwhile for us someday to come back and look at this. But now I want to look at a couple of other rulings, a couple of other instances regarding Sumacus. Okay, so let's go to page 3. Tanu Rabbanan. Achar patirato shel Rabbi Meir, amar lahen Rabbi Yehuda l'talmidav, al yikansu talmidei Rabbi Meir l'kan. Right, Rabbi Meir was a controversial figure to begin with. He was considered to be a genius, and he was appointed to be the chacham. Below the Nasi and the head of the Sanhedrin, and he was a genius. But here, once he died, Rabbi Yehuda said, "We don't want any of his students coming into the Beit Midrash anymore." Why? Mipnei, what was their problem? Mipnei shekantraninhein. Translated here is they are vexatious. V'lo l'lmod Torah hein ba'in. They don't come to study Torah. Ella l'kapcheni b'halachot hein ba'in. They come to overwhelm me with their halachot. So what do you think that means? So they're following their teacher's example, right? They come in, and instead of trying to get to the bottom of what the halacha is, they vex me, right? By giving reasons why it could be good, it could be pure, reasons why it could be impure, and not perhaps that's what it means, right? They're too much like their teacher, right? They're too vexing, and they're too confusing like their teacher. Okay, however, Sumacus, who we know was a student of Rabbi Meir, would have nothing of it. And he wanted to get into the Beit Knesset. Dachak Sumacus v'nichnas. Sumacus, you know, if there, whatever, we've discussed already that sometimes there were bouncers in the Beit Midrash who wouldn't let people in for various sort of ethical shortcomings or what have you. Sumacus said, sorry, I'm not gonna take no for an answer. And he literally forced his way in and enters into the house of study. Now it seems like he's doing this because he wants to make sure that his teacher's viewpoint is well represented in the Beit Midrash. If none of Rabbi Meir's students are there, then how are Rabbi Meir's halachot ever gonna become understood or accepted? Now, by the way, this little story could also help us understand why the halacha never followed Rabbi Meir. because if his students were barred from the yeshiva, maybe he never got the type of access and the type of exposure that that others had, which would maybe have led to his halachot being more widespread. But be that as it may, Sumakus was not going to let his Rebbe be disrespected, and he barges in to the Beit Midrash. Amar Lahem. So they get to the topic of the Mishnah that we just that this Gemara follows, which is a topic of purity and impurity. Now we know that Rabbi Meir and Sumakus had a lot to say about purity and impurity. Al Elu Tumot Hanazir Migaleach. Rabbi Meir taught, Sumakus said to them, my Rebbe, my teacher, Rabbi Meir taught me like this. A Nazirite shaves for becoming impure from these following sources of impurity. When a Nazirite became impure, in order to achieve, to go back to the status of being pure, a few things had to be done, and one of them is he had to shave. So what type of impurity create the situation where the Nazir has to shave? Al elu tumot ha-Nazir megaleach, al hamet ve'al kizayit min hamet. For impurity parted by a corpse, and for impurity parted by an olive bulk of a corpse. Okay? Does that bother anybody?
What's an olive bulk?
Kizayit. Like the amount of matzah you eat on the Pesach Seder. A piece of a corpse, exactly. A piece of a corpse. A little piece of a corpse.
Olive size.
Olive size. Does that statement bother anybody?
Yeah.
Besides, that's gross. That's not what I'm talking about. You think there are corpses everywhere?
Well, people are dying left and right.
I don't know about that. Could be. But that's...
You probably have to shave a lot.
Oh, you're saying how could a Nazir possibly become... Okay, that's not what he's talking about. It seems redundant. If a Nazir has to shave for an olive's bulk volume of a corpse, then certainly he has to shave for the whole corpse. It seems unnecessary to say both. But nonetheless, Sumakus comes along and says both. So this now Rabbi Meir is upset. Kaas Rabbi Yehuda. Now this is the vexing. Like, why is Sumakus coming in and telling us these things? One of them is unnecessary. He's going to get us all confused. Kaas Rabbi Yehuda va'amar lahen lo kach amarti lachem. Rabbi Yehuda says to his student, "Didn't I tell you al yikansu talmidei Rabbi Meir lekan, not to let these guys in? They're up to no good. We don't want them in our Beit Midrash. Mivnei shekantarin hein, because they are vexatious," right? And he's annoyed. Why is he annoyed? Al kizayit min hamet migaleach al hamet lo kol shekain. Like we just said, isn't it obvious? He made an unnecessary statement. As if a Nazirite must shave for impurity imparted by an olive bulk from a corpse. Is it not all the more so that he must shave for impurity imparted by an entire corpse? So now you may want to say, well, that's Rabbi Meir getting all upset about. I mean, okay, so it doesn't actually sound to me like Sumakus is being vexatious. It sounds like Sumakus is not so sharp.
It's hitting me. Okay, I just touched it. It was just this much, as opposed to somebody who's really dealing with the...
No, it's not about how much of it you touch. It's how much of it is present. The whole body is present, and if even a little olive's bulk, this much of a corpse is present, the rest of the corpse is gone.
This is not a touching that you have to touch it to be impure. It's just
whether you have to touch it or not doesn't make a difference. Meaning, it doesn't make a difference how much of a full body you touch. Once you touch the full body, you've touched the full body. But even if only a little piece of it is there, the rest of the corpse is gone. You're still tameh. Right? So Rabbi Meir gets all upset about this. Again, which seems to be a little bit of an overreaction. Like I said before, it seems to me like Sumakus is not so sharp after all. Why would he say something that is redundant?
Maybe he's giving the general, he's saying if he touches a corpse or he's in the room with a corpse, and then he says, and it's not just the corpse, even if just a little bit is there.
There are sometimes that the Talmud will try to give an answer that not this, even this, but usually it's not so obvious. This is very obvious, it seems, that if it's a piece, but that's an excellent...
Why would you have made an excellent
Amora, Marilyn.
Why would they even have a piece of a corpse?
That's a good question, too. But let's say there's some, you know, an accident. I mean, it happens. An accident, a human body can get dismembered.
Yeah.
You're trying to keep it together.
What's that? Well, right, you're trying to get it to keep it together. But let's say all that's left is a little tiny, tiny bit. And according to Rhoda, people are just dying left and right. So there are just body parts all over the place.
So if you encounter a part of a body, but the person's still alive, is it not?
Oh, that's a good question. I'm not sure about that. But here, it's a dead body or a piece of a dead body, not a piece of flesh of a person who's still living. Excellent. Okay, so let's turn to page 4 because we're still not done.
They didn't do things like that.
Didn't do things like what?
It looks like it's part of surgery or something.
Well, maybe so. It could have been. It could have been an accident. It could have been an accident. It could have been a body which was attacked by a wild animal, and there are pieces. And a wild animal drags a piece of a corpse into town. Happens here all the time. Yeah. All right. So let's get out of the zombie land and get back into the Gemara. Page 4, right? So now we're back in the Beit Midrash, and Rabbi Yehuda is all upset that Tsumachus came and gave this ruling. Rabbi Yossi said, Amar Rabbi Yossi, Yomru Meir Shachav. Now the people will say Meir is dead, right? Tsumachus' teacher, the great sage, is dead. Yehuda Ka'as. Yehuda is angry. Because he's angry that they let this guy into the Beit Midrash. Yossi Shatak. And Yossi remained silent and didn't say anything the whole time. Torah Matehe Aleha. What is going to be, right? He says, if so, what will become of the Torah study? Rabbi Yossi therefore said, it is not necessary to teach that a Nazirite must shave for impurity imparted by a corpse, but only that he may shave even for impurity imparted by a corpse upon which there is not an olive bulk of flesh, right? Rabbi Yossi, Torah Matiela, Amar Rabbi Yossi, Lo Nitrucha Ela Lemeit She'ein Aleha Kizayat Basar. He said, no, the halacha is, that even if there's less than a kizayat, right? It is not necessary to teach that a Nazirite must shave for impurity imparted by a corpse, but only that he must shave even for impurity imparted by a corpse upon which there is not an olive bulk of flesh. The Gemara asks, V'adayin Yomar, the Gemara asks, but one could still say if he must shave for impurity imparted by a limb from a corpse, even if there is less than an olive bulk, as is stated in the Mishnah, is it not all the more so that he must shave for impurity imparted by all of a corpse, even if it does not contain an olive bulk of flesh? You're back to the same problem. If you have to shave for even less than a kizayit, then all the more so you have to shave for a kizayit, for a full body that's less than a kizayit. What's going on? Ella, k'da'amar Rabbi Yochanan, lo nitzricha ella linafel shelo nitkarshu evara begidin. Rather, the Mishnah should be explained, as Rabbi Yochanan said, with regard to a different issue. It is necessary only for a miscarried fetus whose limbs had not yet become joined to its sinews. Here, too, one can say that the Mishnah statement that a Nazirite must shave for impurity imparted by a corpse is referring to a miscarried fetus whose limbs were not yet become joined. Now we're getting too much into the detail. Let's get to the end. The last statement is, this halacha could not have been derived from the measure of impurity of part of the body as this corpse is very small. So in the end, they come to defend the ruling that was given in the Beit Midrash in the shul, in the study hall. But what we see here is that this guy Tsumachus got under Rabbi Yehuda's skin and really, really annoyed him, and he didn't want him in the in there at all. Okay, but nonetheless, he refused to be excluded, and refused not to have his Rebbe's teachings discussed in the Beit Midrash. Now, there's another similar story. There are two more similar stories. If you look on page 5. Tanu Rabbanan, bottom paragraph. Lachar p'tirato, same story, Rabbi Meir. Amar lehem Rabbi Yehuda l'tamidav, al yikansu tamidei Rabbi Meir l'kan, mipnei shekantraninheim, v'lo l'lmod torahim ba'im, ela l'kapcheni b'halachot heim ba'im. Same thing, we don't want any Rabbi Meir's students. They're trouble. Dachak sumakus v'nichnas. Again, sumakus comes in. It's unclear if this was the same day, the same discussion. La'achar patirato doesn't have to mean right after he died, but in the period after Rabbi Meir's death, there was a ban on Rabbi Meir's students from coming into the Beit Midrash, and from time to time, sumakus would barge in to defend his teacher, and he would say, Kach shanali Rabbi Meir, ha-mikadesh b'chelko, ben kachei kadashim, ben kadashim kalim, lo kidesh. With regard to a priest who betroths the woman with his portion of the offering, whether he did so with offerings of the most sacred order, or whether he used offerings of lesser sanctity, he has not betrothed her. And Rabbi Yehuda is going to come up and say the same thing. If he does not betroth her with something of lesser sanctity, then certainly he has not betrothed her with something of greater sanctity. Why is he, you know, why is he bothering me? Why is he bothering me with this? And that's the back page. Kas Rabbi Yehuda Amar Alehem. He got upset. Amar Alehem. Lo kach amarti lachem. I told you. Al yikansu talmidei Rabbi Meir kan. I don't want him in here. Right? Mifnei shekantarinheim. They're vexatious. And they don't come here to learn. El lekapcheni. V'chi isha ba'azara minayin. Actually, it's, I'm sorry, I was wrong. Right? A woman, right? This halacha is not relevant. As from where would a woman appear in the temple courtyard? Women may not appear in the area of the temple courtyard where the priests eat the offerings of the most sacred order. So there is no reason to address this impossible scenario. So Rabbi Yehuda seems to be very concerned with practical matters. If something is not a practical matter, don't come into the Beit Midrash and get us all confused with your fancy logic, right? We just want to get down to practicality. In this case, we have a similar conversation. Amar Rabbi Yossi, Yomer Meir Shachav Yehuda Kas Yossi Shatak. This fellow, Rabbi Yossi, seems to be very concerned with the honor of the Torah. Rabbi Meir's dead, so he can't answer. Rabbi Yehuda is angry, and he's sort of taking himself out of the game. I'm standing here. People are going to say, I was quiet, so I got to say something. So he said, Torah Mateele, what's going to happen to Torah? He said, no, this halacha is relevant. Adam ba'azara. A man can accept betrothal on behalf of his daughter in the azara. So now it becomes a question of what the Kohen is allowed to use to betroth his daughter. There is no need to give the betrothal lamb directly to the woman. It can be given to her father. Anyone here get engaged that way? What, Jonas, you gave the ring to Rhoda's father to give to her? That is so romantic.
Dove made a bet with my father about baseball in Havana, and he proved my father wrong.
Okay, so if anyone's watching at home, this is another option, right? There is no need to give the betrothed item directly to the woman. It can be given to her father. And additionally, isn't it common for women to designate an agent for herself to accept her betrothal in the courtyard? And furthermore, what will be the halacha if a woman pushed and entered, right? Like you, Sumkus pushed his way into the Beit Midrash without permission and against the rules. What if a woman pushes her way into the Azara of the Beit HaMikdash and someone betroths her? We need to know. So again, in this case, like the last case, Sumakus was not totally pie in the sky. He was, he had something legitimate to say, which is also interesting in the sense that Rabbi Yehuda, who was also a great sage, right, couldn't see that. He was, it seems to me like he was so upset with Sumakus and so angry that they let him in and so against any of Rabbi Meir's students coming into the Beit Midrash that he couldn't stop and think for a second that maybe Sumakus had a point. And he wasn't just being vexatious. He actually had real Torah to teach in the name of his Rebbe, Rabbi Meir, that was real, that was legitimate. So
human nature, I think. When somebody doesn't like somebody, right. They'll say it's black, and you'll say it's white.
Right,
even though
exactly, right. That's
ordinarily, I think, would have said it's black.
Right, I think that's exactly what's going on here. And I would have agreed with you even if I didn't like you. Okay, so a few more things about Tsumakus. There's this fascinating collection. It's sort of an encyclopedia. I didn't have time to copy it for you because of our we're off campus, right? And so I found it late in the day, and I couldn't get it copied. It's called Otzer Yisrael, which is basically an encyclopedia of halachic and Talmudic terms. And there's also entries for the rabbis of the Talmud. And there is an entry for our friend Tsumakus. And he makes a really interesting point. Right? We started out our discussion of Tsumakus, that he was a genius, right? That he was able to prove 49 ways why something was pure and 49 ways why something was impure. Okay, but the author of the Otzer Yisrael says the following. I'll read it to you and translate. It's really neat. It says, Af al pi shehaya mipulpal gadol, even though Tsumakus was excellent in pilpul, which is a Talmudic argumentation, right? Like he could look at something and say this is impure and come up with 49 explanations as to why it was impure. And we saw that in the Beit Midrash, he was able to come up with applications of halacha that even Rabbi Yehuda wasn't able to, or maybe because of his anger to him, but even Rabbi Yehuda was not able to consider as possibilities, right? So he was really a very, very smart person. Kinireh lo yarad leomka shel halacha. Nonetheless, says the Otzer Yisrael, he may not have been as careful in analyzing the halacha and getting to the bottom of the halacha as he should have. What's the proof of that? Why would we say such a thing? So he says, ki lo nimtzaim mimenu rak b'shlosha mikomot b'mishnah. Despite Tsumakus's very, very well-developed skills of argumentation, he is only mentioned in three Mishnayot in all of the Talmud. And not only that, v'shtei halachotav amar mishum Rabbi Meir. And two of them, he says in the name of his teacher, Rabbi Meir. So there's only one original halacha in all of the Mishnayot mentioned by Tsumakus. So he says, Tsumakus omer b'chulin. He says something, in Masechet Eruvin, ve'ein halacha kidvarav, and we don't follow him. Tsumakus omer mishum Rabbi Meir in Baba Metzia. He says in the name of Rabbi Meir in Baba Metzia, and there the halacha is like him, but it's really, he's saying in the name of his teacher. And Tsumakus omer mishum Rabbi Meir, and he says something else in the name of Rabbi Meir in Chulin, and the halacha is not like him. So you have these two sides of the coin of Tsumakus' reputation. On the one hand, he was a genius. He was able to come up with multiple reasons to defend any halacha. On the other hand, he's barely mentioned in the Mishnah. And so it leads the Otzer Yisrael to conclude that maybe he wasn't as deep of a thinker, or as he wasn't as careful as a halachist as he should have been, and which is why the halacha does not follow him. And so that is just, it's hard. So with the real Tsumakus, you know, please stand up. Who was he? It's hard to know. He was able to come up with something that Rabbi Yehuda couldn't understand, yet he doesn't get a lot of play when it comes to halachot in his name in the Mishnah. Just one other thing about Tsumakus. One of the halachot that he's most known for is as follows. Mamon hamutal besafek cholkin below shivua. If someone has money and a doubt arises as to whether or not it's your money, Tsumakus says, you just split it. right? It's unclear whose money it is, so we're just going to split it, okay? That goes against the more well-known opinion in the Gemara that says, Hamotzi mechaveiro alav haraya. That if you have money and I say it's mine, okay, I have to prove it, right? Possession is not nine-tenths of the law. Possession is the law. Unless I can prove somehow that you that the money that you have is mine, you keep it. Sumakus disagrees. He says, no, mamon hamutal b'safek, cholkin b'lo shavua. Just split it without any shavua. So why is that? Right? What's behind that? What's the real point that of these two positions? The point of the more well-known position of Hamotzi mechaveiro alav haraya, that if you're trying to take something from someone, this is the way it works in our, in most legal systems, I think. If you have a lawnmower and I say it's mine, I have to prove it's mine. I can't just come and take it. And no one's going to say, well, give him half the worth of the lawnmower. Right? So what's behind this? Anyone want to take a stab at that? What's the sort of philosophical difference between the position that says, Sumakus's position that says, split it, or the other position of, no, if you are claiming something that someone else has in their possession, you have to prove it. So which one is that? That's the proof. That's the Motzimin Chaver Lev Haraya. Oh, giving half to both? So even if the other person's lying,
right,
you want to give them half of it.
Well, maybe they're lying
because they need it. Okay?
They just plain want it.
But then, right, they do want it. Then why? Well, I understand what Rhoda's saying. If they need it, then maybe we should split it. But although that's really not fair to the guy who really owns it.
Is he trying to
just... now you got it. That's exactly what they're disagreeing on, right? It seems that the disagreement is between two different worldviews. One worldview is compromise, and the other worldview is truth. Right? Usually those things, truth and compromise, are often opposites, right? Because if something's true, if someone's right, they shouldn't have to compromise, right? So Sumakus seems to be the one who wants to compromise. Just split it. Let's not have any fighting, right? While the position that says Hamotzi mechaver elav haraya, that seems to be after the truth. You have it, and you can't just come and take it away because you want it, or even if you need it. You can't just take someone else's property, something else is in their property. So Sumakus's opinion to split it is sort of an ideal solution, right? However, it injures truth, right? It comes at the cost of truth, right? But Sumakus is willing, for the sake of peace, to pay the price, to pay truth as a price in order to achieve peace. The Chachamim, right, the rabbis who say, no, you have to prove that it's yours, right, they are more interested in emet, right? And as long as there's no clear proof that it's yours, a Beit Din can't decide to come along and take something out of your hands. Right? I guess like an eminent domain. That would be very, very rare for, this is not eminent domain, the government's not keeping with Beit Din, can't just come along and say, no, you have to give up your thing. I found this very interesting, right? Because Sumakus is the one who, according to this viewpoint, if we understand it this way, likes everyone to get along and there to be peace. But he's also the one who forced his way into the Beit Midrash in order to get his teachers, you know, word out there for everyone to know. So you could argue that was also about shalom. He's saying we should all be in the Beit Midrash, right? We all have the right to be in the Beit Midrash. You can't lock us out of the Beit Midrash just because I'm a difficult student, right? And maybe they're like, no, we just want to go after the truth, and you're too complicated, and you get us off track, and you take us off topic, and you say things which are irrelevant, even though we proved that they were relevant. So we don't want you because we're about Emmet. And he's like, no, I'm about Pshara, about compromise, and I'm very sorry that if you don't like the way that I study, but I deserve a right to be in here, just like anyone else deserves the right to be in here. But the way he gets that is by, you know, ramming his way through the bouncer who's supposed to keep Rabbi Meir's students out. Anyway, so that is a little bit about our friend Sumakus. Like I said, either he is Sumakus, the son of Yosef, Sumakus, the son of Isi, or Sumakus, the son of Yossi, whoever he is. Fascinating character, genius, maybe too smart for his own good, like his teacher was, Rabbi Meir. A little bit of a bull in a china shop, but also maybe someone who was ultimately concerned with maintaining peace and equanimity within the community, within the Beit Midrash, and even when it comes to judicial rulings. Okay, everybody.
I'm sitting here thinking of this from a TV.